Conduct Unbecoming by Howard Parkhurst. The young man sitting across the table stared back at me defiantly. "I'm not going to lick your butt," he said. Understanding that he was attempting to use a more polite euphemism for kiss your ass, I assured him that I had no expectations that he do so, and that I wasn't the sort of professor who wanted students to bow in obeisance. Inwardly, though, I was amazed that a 23-year-old college student would consider saying such a thing to a professor, let alone the professor who would decide whether or not he was recommended for state teacher certification. Student teachers at my university take two courses during their student teaching experience, student teaching and student teaching seminar. The seminar is an academic class that serves a dual purpose. One, it provides academic work directly related to practicing the professional knowledge and skills students are supposed to have attained through their undergraduate preparation. And two, it gives student teachers a group of peers with whom to share experiences and to commiserate about the problems they encounter. As an off-campus-based professor and student teaching coordinator, my role is to place a group of student teachers, observe them in their student teaching assignments, and teach their seminar class, which meets once a week in the late afternoon. At the beginning of the semester, in addition to the syllabus, students receive a great many forms that must be filled out. These forms provide information about their cooperating or host teachers, their schools, and various university requirements. Further, at the first class meeting, I give a pretest to determine if there are any basic areas that need review. For a closure activity, at the end of one particular first class meeting, I ask students to list on a sheet of paper two important concepts covered in class that evening. Jacob, a pseudonym I'll use for the young man with whom I had the interchange recounted above, answered almost all of the pretest questions, "Doesn't affect me, I'm in art." For the two concepts in the closure activity, this young man put down "too many forms" and "Dr. Parkhurst makes weird noises." I would have thought these responses humorous had they come from a seventh grader in my previous life as a middle school teacher. I would have laughed, but I would not have given them credit. From a 23-year-old, they didn't strike me as funny. They struck me as bizarre and age inappropriate. He was, after all, old enough to understand the purpose of the activity and to realize that his answers did not fulfill that purpose. And the class had been told that class participation points were at stake for any written work they did in class. An automobile accident caused me to miss the next class meeting. In my absence, the adjunct who worked with me ran the class, only to be blindsided by strident complaints about the number of assignments and the volume of work required in the class emanating from, you guessed it, the young man of the butt-licking response, who had apparently instigated protests from several other class members as well. Despite extensive experience teaching at the community college level, the adjunct had never dealt with this type of reaction to what seemed to him a perfectly normal, reasonable syllabus, and he didn't quite know how to respond to the students. After all, he was not responsible for teaching the class or for designing the course assignments. During my 12 years of teaching at the college level, I had never encountered this type of reaction either, but I immediately emailed class members detailing assignments from other student teaching seminars around the state and noting that our seminar's assignments were reasonably in line with those of other student teaching centers and, in some cases, made fewer demands on their time than others. I sent an additional email message to Jacob, asking him to stay after class to talk to me. He stayed, but informed me that he was staying because he wanted to talk about his grade. I thought, but did not say, "No, you're staying because I asked you to." It was at the start of the ensuing conversation that the butt-licking statement made its appearance. Jacob continued by informing me that none of the student teachers wanted to be in the seminar, a required class for all student teachers, that they all thought it was a waste of their time, and that he was only voicing what they all felt. I have no idea what he thought I might do about this, since my university requires the class of all student teachers. I couldn't exactly wave my magic wand and make it disappear. Ironically, in the written reflection he had turned in concerning his experiences during the past week, he told of a seventh grader he had sent out of art class, a required class for the seventh grader, for not respecting the class. When I pointed out this irony to him, his response was, "Oh, cute." He claimed to see no similarity at all in the two situations, his and the seventh grader's. During the course of that conversation, however, we did establish what seemed to be a fragile working relationship. In his student teaching position, he broke a number of rules about which he had been clearly informed. For example, he let students listen to iPods and MP3 players in class in violation of school rules. Another time, he allowed another college student into the classroom to observe without first obtaining permission from his cooperating teacher or the school. He apologized for each infraction, insisting that they were innocent mistakes. When his cooperating teacher required written lesson plans, he made clear his distaste for the paperwork she expected of him. No single offense was severe enough to incur immediate termination of his student teaching assignment, but as I told his cooperating teacher, it was like being stoned to death with pebbles. Constructive criticisms were met with what his cooperating teacher and I interpreted as disdain, and unless we insisted, he made no changes. In his student teaching classroom, however, Jacob's teaching performance was exemplary, both at the middle school and the high school. He rapidly established rapport with his students, particularly the seventh and eighth graders. Despite his issues with the seventh grader guilty of not respecting the class, Jacob's classroom management problems were minimal. His explanations were clear and easy to understand. He used technology judiciously and incorporated it into his teaching appropriately. The concepts of other disciplines were integrated into classroom exercises. For example, one art exercise made use of grammar concepts. Two students with emotional problems, one of whom was considering suicide, confided in Jacob, who dealt professionally and appropriately with the situations. In short, to any adult not working directly with him in a supervisory capacity, Jacob would have appeared to be every parent's and administrator's dream teacher. Clearly, Jacob had a lot of potential, but just as clearly, the contempt he visibly evidenced for institutional requirements, coupled with his lack of respect for legitimate authority, were going to make it difficult for him to keep a teaching job. His cooperating teacher and I agreed that he would find it hard to work cooperatively with other faculty members if he continued to disagree forcefully with their teaching methods or classroom decisions. Further, the first time his school administration came up with an idea that Jacob felt in his heart of hearts was ill-advised, he would make his disapproval obvious and incur much administrative wrath. We shuddered at the thought of his first conference with parents who told him their child's grade in his class did not matter because it was just art. We marveled at the possibility that a student could navigate the entire education system all the way to the level of a senior in college without gaining more understanding of how to maintain positive professional relationships. Nevertheless, when we talked to Jacob about these matters, he earnestly assured us that, more than anything else in the world, he wanted to be a teacher. The camel's back finally gave way when Jacob's cooperating teacher told him to have lesson plans done at the end of the day for the last two classes he was to take over. This directive came in a collective conversation on a Friday after I had observed him. I heard her say it. I heard Jacob acknowledge it. She had it in writing. All three of us saw it in writing. But Jacob did not get the lesson plans done. The cooperating teacher called me. I emailed Jacob, reminding him that all of us were aware of the lesson plan requirement, then said that if another incident occurred where he broke school rules or did not have required paperwork completed, I was going to have to assign him an additional month of student teaching in another site to help him learn to follow professional requirements. The following Monday, I stopped at the school during Jacob's preparation period. Sitting down across a table from him, I carefully, slowly, and painstakingly explained the effect his reactions were having on other people, modeled his body language and the interpretations others made of it, and again explained the concerns that his cooperating teacher and I had. When he tried to interrupt or tell me he already understood, I stopped him and told him to just listen. Somehow, in that slow, halting conversation, where I examined almost every word to make sure that I was saying what I wanted to say and could not be misinterpreted, Jacob began to get a glimmer of how his responses differed from those of other people in his position and the effect those responses were having on others. I explained again the necessity of completing paperwork so that he could make his planning visible to others. The small bit of understanding generated that day, coupled with the stress of the possibility of an extra month of student teaching, an extra month with incoming bills and no incoming money, seemed to spark the first real social and emotional growth his cooperating teacher and I had seen in him. Jacob still did not appear overeager to turn in detailed lesson plans, but he did so without complaint. In the seminar, he began to show signs of taking his teacher's perspective, something he had not done before. He still occasionally asked why the class was doing a particular assignment or activity, but when the explanation was given, rather than indicate disdain, he'd nod and respond, "Oh." He informed the adjunct and me that he had an art show coming up in a community about 100 miles away, and it appeared that, though he would not ask, he wanted us to attend. Now here's the thing. Because I was fairly new to my position, I hadn't realized, back when Jacob first told me that he wouldn't lick my butt, that I could have sent him packing right then and there for a lack of respect and professionalism. I had been told by another coordinator that he thought I had to first take the student teacher through an action plan process, a procedure that identifies the areas in which the student teacher needs to improve, sets goals, and states how those goals will be achieved. In later discussions with more experienced coordinators, I discovered that I could have ended my relationship with Jacob and forced him to find another coordinator with whom he could work. The most minor effect of this would probably have been delaying Jacob's student teaching for a semester, since other coordinators in the same geographic area had full student loads. It's also entirely possible that Jacob would have dropped out of teaching altogether as a result. No doubt many would have applauded his departure. The importance of attitudes conducive to good teaching and to the safety of young people in those who aspire to be educators is obvious, but it's also important to remember that attitudes change and that people preparing to be teachers are typically still adolescents themselves, with all the flux and flow of opinions, beliefs, and ideas typical of that age. In addition, it's worth remembering that individuals mature at different rates. My personal responses to Jacob aside, more and more in recent years, entry into teaching is being constrained in two ways that do not relate directly to the acquisition of knowledge and skills and the ability to convey them to learners. One of these is the rendering of moralistic judgments about past follies and foibles, as in the case of 27-year-old Stacy Snyder, who recently sued Pennsylvania's Millersville University. Her suit claims that she was denied a teaching certificate because of a MySpace photo that showed her holding a cup of what was interpreted as beer, but could have been anything, something neither illegal nor deemed immoral by millions and millions of Americans. The second barrier to entry is the subjective use of sets of dispositions, attitudes, and personality traits considered inappropriate for teachers to make decisions about the fitness of individuals for the field of teaching, as in the situation of Edward Swan. Despite having four biracial children, he was labeled a white supremacist at Washington State University, where his camouflage hunting cap and stated love of hunting further alarmed a professor. At the beginning of Jacob's student teaching semester, no matter how stellar his performance in the classroom, he had at the very least violated the norms regarding professional respect, professional communication, collaboration with others, and emotional maturity. Despite his fervent desire to become a teacher, his dispositions in these areas would probably have made Jacob's dream impossible. And yet, here was a young man who earnestly wished to become a teacher and who was clearly talented, whose performance in the classroom with students was exemplary. Had I summarily dismissed him, as I later learned I could have done, or had he been referred to a committee to judge his fitness for teaching, his abilities would probably have been lost to the profession. He would have taken a job somewhere in another field. And I would not have received my first hug from a departing student teacher.